This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Sam Brigger in for Terry Gross. Terry has today's first interview. Here she is.
Tennessee's new anti-drag law goes into effect April 1st. My guest, Bella Duval, is a drag queen who's the show director and host at the largest drag club in Memphis, the Atomic Rose. She's also the creator of the club's drag competition. Bella is sounding the alarm about how this law could result in shutting down drag clubs and imprisoning many drag queens. The law pertains to, quote, male or female impersonators who provide entertainment that appeals to a prurient interest, unquote, and puts those performances in the category of adult cabaret performance, the same category as topless dancers and strippers. It's an offense for a person to engage in an adult cabaret performance on public property or in a location where the performance could be viewed by a person who is not an adult. The first offense for violating the new law is a misdemeanor with a fine of up to $2,500 and up to 6 months in jail. All subsequent violations would be felonies, punishable by up to 6 years in prison. At least 14 other states have proposed anti-drag bills. Bella has lived in Tennessee all her life, where she's been performing in drag for 10 years. She describes her drag persona as part Miss Piggy, part Dolly Parton, part Mr. Rogers. Bella Duval, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure.
I just want to get straight and have the audience understand what pronouns you prefer.
Sure. Out of drag, I use they, them, but in drag, I use she, her.
And what would you like me to use today?
Today, let's just go ahead and use she, her, since most people are accustomed to referring to me as Bella.
Very good. So the anti-drag law goes into effect April 1st, which is really soon. What's it been like now in this intermediate period when the law has been signed but not in effect yet? What's it been like to perform at the club?
There's still a little bit of a weird limbo. You know, we're coming out of a time of a lot of fear, a lot of anger, a lot of confusion. But since the law has been signed and the cavalry has kind of shown up, I think we've become a lot bolder and a lot more sure that we are on the right side of history. So for us, performance has become a little bit more about activism and putting our thoughts and our feelings out into our performances. And I think also it's become a time when everybody really wants to stand up and be an example.
I know your answer to this question is going to be everything, but what do the legislators and the governor of Tennessee not understand about drag? And like I said, I know the answer will be everything, but get more specific.
Well, the questions that I've had are about defining drag. You know, I've been doing drag for 10 years, and every time somebody asks me to define it, I think it gets a little harder to try and pin down. I cannot succinctly put into words what the entire art of drag is. And the fact that these legislators, who know far less about the art than I do and have never been to a drag show, are sitting up there making these laws, that's a little upsetting. For me, the idea that they think that every drag performer is doing something hypersexual or obscene obviously means they don't know very much about it. Also, there is extremely, extremely vague language in this bill, you know, in saying male and female impersonators. One of my largest fears is that this bill will actually be misused to target trans people, gender nonconforming people, or non-binary folks. Right now in the GOP, you know, you have people like Michael Knowles at CPAC saying transgenderism must be eradicated from public life entirely. And if I am to accept that these people only look at transgenderism as an ideology, not real people, then it's very easy for me to believe that by extension, they could look at a trans person and say, that is a male impersonator. That is a female impersonator. And so my real fear is that a lot of this vague language is very, very intentional so that it could be misused to target people that the bill is not specifically written about.
I think it was the same day that the anti-drag bill was signed. There was an anti-trans bill that was signed by the governor
Correct.
Of Tennessee. Describe
yes.
that bill.
Yeah, SB1 and SB3 were signed the same day, and SB1 will outlaw all gender-affirming health care for trans youth in the state. I believe that one goes into effect in June. It's either June or July, and they will be given until March of next year to work with their doctors to, quote, detransition. And for me to see both of these things signed in the same day, it's absolutely not a coincidence. This is a concentrated attack. It's meant to send a message, as with all these legislations, that they don't want queer people in Tennessee.
In the anti-drag law, it's an offense for a person to engage in an adult cabaret performance on public property or in a location where the adult cabaret performance could be viewed by a person who's not an adult. And since drag is now defined as adult cabaret, what does that mean for your club? Like, you have shows for whole families, including children, that are, you know, matinees. What won't you be able to do at your club?
Yeah, if the law stands as it is and is enforced the way that they would like it to be, then we would not be able to welcome people under the age of 18 into our all-ages brunch. If it stands that they will not allow any drag being classified as adult cabaret here in public, that means no drag performers in the Pride Parade and Festival. As a minister, I've been asked to marry couples in public in drag. I don't know if that would be legal anymore, if my religious freedom supersedes this law or if it would be infringed upon. Also, again, just for myself as a non-binary person who wears clothing that does not necessarily match the gender that I was assigned at birth, I am fearful that just all these people like me who are presenting authentically in their daily life, that someone's going to see me in Kroger in a dress and call the cops and say, this person's being obscene in front of my kids.
So you can't appear in public or walk around outside in drag. Do you often appear in public in drag? Do you promote your shows in public in drag?
Well, you know, I get ready here at home and then I go to the venue. So I'm worried the small amount of time that I'm walking from the parking garage to the venue, is that public? Our venue has large windows and we're off of Beale Street. If there are people walking by with their kids and they glance through the windows, is that now being viewed by a minor despite the fact that they're looking through the windows into our private establishment? So for me, again, there's just some really, really vague terminology, and that's where most of my fear and confusion lies.
You know what I've been wondering? Would somebody who wants to punish a drag performer encourage their child to wait at the entrance of a drag club, for instance, and then report a person walking in there, you know, and the person might have had like no intention of being seen by a child, but a child was stationed outside the door or in the parking lot that you just described. And then you'd have to face possible jail.
First time is a misdemeanor charge. The second would be a felony that carries up to 6 years in prison.
And even the first time, the misdemeanor, that's up to 6 months. That's a long time.
Yeah.
Not as long as 6 years, but it's long enough.
That's it. Yeah. Considering I've made it 43 years without a charge. Yes, I would prefer to not have to endure that just for doing my job or living my constitutionally protected expression.
Do you think I'm just being paranoid thinking that a child might be intentionally stationed to report somebody in drag?
Absolutely not. No. I mean, given the fact that I've seen the network of the Proud Boys, you know, putting out their APBs on where you can find drag performances, especially ones that involve kids. And, you know, right now, Texas, looking at similar legislations, has proposed a bill that will basically instate drag bounty hunters. And they'll be offered $5,000 a person that they can turn in that they have proof of violating this law. So absolutely, if someone thinks they could make a quick buck on it, yeah, you bet they'd station their kid outside and say, look what they did.
That's like the abortion law where there's
it is. It is. It is turning people into mercenaries and bounty hunters.
So tell us more about what this law will mean to you personally as an individual trying to live your life.
I think, again, my biggest fear is that they're going to try and chill my constitutionally protected expression. And living here in Memphis in a blue pocket of this red state, I'm not as fearful. Our district attorney, Steve Mulroy, as soon as the law was signed, came out and said, this law is unnecessary. It is unfair. It's going to chill free speech. This is not okay. And I personally believe that there's not a single show happening in my county that is in violation of this law. So he said that he had no real intent to enforce it. So that makes me feel a little safer. But I grew up in a little bitty farm community in West Tennessee, and it's those smaller places where I do think that someone would literally just misuse this law to try and harm a trans person in their community that they don't like. I grew up close to Jackson, and in the last year, Jackson had one of its first public pride shows, and they asked me to come and host that. We were originally set to do it in Conger Park, which is a public park space, and there was a lot of public backlash about putting a drag show in a public space that kids could see it, despite the fact that, of course, everything was on target to be family-friendly and appropriate for all ages. We ended up negotiating and moving the entire event indoors so that it would not be in a public place. And they continued to push, and we ended, the committee caved to them and raised the age to 18 that, you know, to be able to enter Pride at all. So it's those smaller communities where people are already vilifying queer people and trying to push us out that I'm afraid that they will really, really misuse this law, because they may be under jurisdictions that are not as forgiving. You know, they may not have a district attorney who says the things that ours has said. And those people I'm worried for.
The message being sent in Jackson apparently is, go ahead and express pride, but just do it in the closet, please.
Mm-hmm. That's what this whole thing has been about. You know, for the longest time, the message that we've received is, you can live your life, but just don't put it in our faces. You know, keep it in private. So for the most part...
Or we'll put you in jail.
Right. So for the most part, we were just like doing it in private, living peacefully. And now they've said, now we're going to take those spaces away from you too. And we're going to make those safe spaces no longer safe for queer youth. So it's like, wait, how much more do you want? How much more are you going to take? We thought we were, you know, staying in our lane and being quiet over here.
So it's not only like your freedom to be yourself that's at stake, your income is at stake, because... that's your job. That's your income.
That is my livelihood. And all these people who are like, well, you shouldn't have that as a job. You shouldn't be around kids. It's my supreme joy to tell them, well, if I have to quit doing drag, I'm going to go back to my old job, teaching. So if you don't want
that.
Me around your kids, I got really bad news for you.
What did you teach?
Theater. Yeah, I'm a founding member of the Tennessee Shakespeare Company, and it was through Shakespeare that I first came to drag.
Yeah, because men, like women weren't allowed to perform in Shakespeare's era, so men did women's clothes in drag.
So I got paid really good money by the National Endowment for the Arts and the state of Tennessee to go into all these schools and play drag roles in front of their students. It was okay then, but it's not okay now.
There's a video of you introducing the show to one of the, I think it's one of the family shows. You ask, like, who's in the audience for whom this is the first time you've been to a drag show? Mm-hmm. And then you explain what to expect. So what do you tell those audiences?
Usually, if they've never been to a drag show, I consider my role as the host to prime them for what they're going to see and help guide them through what's going on. So normally I just tell people that I'm going to introduce the entertainers, tell them a little bit about what each person is going to present, and then they come out and perform. If you like what they're doing, you scream, you cheer, you, yes! Because we're in a live space, so it's not like TV and we can see and hear you. The noise will really get them working, but if you want to see my dolls work, you have to give them some money. And my tagline on that is always, because it takes a lot of money to look this cheap. I do it full time. I can give it to you on good authority.
You also do readings for children. Do you do them at the club or at the library?
I have gone to the library, and I've actually been invited to several of our area churches here to lead drag queen story time for their congregations.
So what gets the biggest reaction from the children?
I think most kids are so taken with the aesthetic. You know, if they're young enough, most of them just think I'm a Disney princess. And, you know, people ask sometimes, they're like, but how do you explain drag to kids? And I'm like, you don't have to. They're the originators of drag. Kids came up with playing dress up. They understand it way better than the rest of us. Some of us just never quit playing.
What's your understanding of why so many people think it's really hilarious and perfectly acceptable for a straight man to dress in women's clothes for a laugh in a variety show or, you know, any kind of sketch comedy, whereas it's really dangerous for a queer person to dress in drag?
Mm-hmm. Isn't it interesting how that standard exists? It's totally fine as long as the person identifies as straight. And I think you actually hit the nail on the head with what you, with how you phrased that. When a straight person does it, it's a joke. I put on this dress because it is to take on femininity, which is less than my masculinity. So don't we laugh at that? Look at how sissified I am. When I put on a dress, it is a statement of strength. It is a statement of how powerful my femininity is. So for me, I think it's about the way that we approach the feminine. You know, the patriarchy has always, you know, used drag as another way to reinforce that women are weaker. I think we as the queer community actually champion that pride, or, you know, that that femininity. We're very proud of something that other people are deeply ashamed of.
A photo has surfaced from Governor Bill Lee's 1977 high school yearbook with him dressed in drag, and I think it was at like a football event of some sort.
It's a Powder Puff football game. So here in the South, we have these old fundraisers that have been going on for decades, and one of them is Powder Puff football, where the boys dress as cheerleaders and the girls dress as football players. My school, we had the Womanless Beauty Review, which is where all of the older brothers and fathers would dress up and put on a beauty pageant. So this is very, very old-style Southern entertainment. You may have seen the clip when the Tennessee Holler put it forth to him, and he said, quote, "That's ridiculous that you would conflate something like that to sexual entertainment in front of children." And I completely agree. They're not the same thing. But he does not agree that he signed a law that makes no such distinction. The law does not draw any distinctions between a school fundraiser or theater or opera, ballet, wrestling, cosplay, people dressing up for Halloween. It's so vague. And that was the real hypocrisy. It was not that he'd been in a dress. It was that he didn't realize that what he was doing was just as innocent as what I do.
You're calling for resistance. What are some of the actions that are being planned in protest against Tennessee's anti-drag law?
There will, of course, be marches, rallies, and things like that, but I think a lot of the protest that we will be doing is active protest. So, for instance, we're continuing all our shows. I will continue to welcome families into our all-ages brunch. I will march in the Pride Parade. So a lot of it that I'm urging Tennesseans to do is active resistance. I think these legislations are aimed at trying to diminish or erase us, trying to get us to sit down and be quiet. And I think the best response to that is to get louder and to be more in your face, to be bolder, and to let them understand that we're not a threat to society. We're a part of it. We belong here too. I've called this state my home for 43 years, and there are a lot of queer people in Tennessee, and I think that we deserve a fair shake of our state too.
Are you concerned about possibly becoming a target because of your videos, especially the one that went viral?
I have, since going viral, received threats of violence and death threats and stuff. That's a new one on me. But I look at that as a very feeble attempt to scare me into being quiet. And I have been confronting bullies since I was about 5 years old. So this is nothing new to me. And I will not cow to intimidation, and I won't be silenced.
Well, I hope that you remain safe and that everything works out for you. Do you ever feel like the people who bullied you when you were a kid in school are similar to the people who are making these laws now? And do you see that as a form of bullying?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. People fear what they don't understand.
Like legal bullying.
It is. It is legal bullying. That's exactly what RuPaul said. RuPaul said there are a bunch of bullies making these laws. And it is true. I think it causes a lot of big feelings when you see someone love in themselves something that you hate in yourself. And to me, that's a big cause of why we're seeing these sort of legislations passed.
You're a minister and you've officiated at wedding ceremonies while dressed in drag. When did you become a minister and what was your motivation for doing it?
I was actually a missionary Baptist minister before I came out. And when I came out as queer, my church kicked me out. And I was devastated at the loss of what I thought was going to be a very supportive and loving family. And I spent several years in a fallout from faith. And as I reconciled my identity and my relationship to the divine, I realized that even though I did not believe within those strictures that I had been taught, I did not feel that my call to serve my community was disingenuous. I very much still believe that I'm supposed to be here to help people. Like, queer people need their ceremonies. They need their guidance. And so I found a more affirming faith and got reordained so that I could continue to serve my community in the ways that I felt compelled.
Bella, it's really been wonderful to talk with you. I wish you safety and, good luck.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. It is an honor and a privilege. The pleasure has been all mine.
And mine.
Bella DeBall is a Memphis-based drag entertainer. She spoke with Terry Gross. When it came out in 1983, Nora Ephron's comic novel Heartburn became an instant bestseller and the literary embodiment of the phrase, "Writing well is the best revenge." A 40th anniversary edition has just been published. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has an appreciation and a review of a new comic novel called Pineapple Street, whose humor, she says, has a 21st century edge.
I met a good friend for dinner the other night and told her I was rereading Nora Ephron's novel Heartburn, which has just come out in a 40th anniversary edition. "I'm so pissed off," this friend said, echoing Meryl Streep's words at Ephron's memorial service in 2012. "Why isn't she still here?" My friend and I locked eyes over our margaritas and nodded. We didn't have to tick off all the ways we needed Ephron's tough wit to help us through things. It's sentimental to say so, but when such a beloved writer's voice is stilled, you really do feel more alone, less armored against the world. I've read Heartburn 3 times since it came out in 1983. Some of its jokes haven't aged well, such as wisecracks about lesbians and Japanese men with cameras, but the pain that underlies its humor is as fresh as a paper cut. For those who don't know the novel, Heartburn takes place mostly in an elite Washington, D.C. world of journalists and politicians, and is a Romana Clay about the breakup of Ephron's marriage to reporter Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame. The year was 1979, and Ephron was pregnant with the couple's second child when she discovered Bernstein was having an affair with Margaret Jay, the then wife of the then British ambassador. In Heartburn, her character is famously skewered as a fairly tall person with a neck as long as an arm and a nose as long as a thumb. Everyone who's read Heartburn or seen the movie with Meryl Streep playing Ephron's fictional alter ego, cookbook author Rachel Samstadt, remembers the climactic dinner party scene where Rachel throws a key lime pie at the face of her cheating husband. In real life, Efron poured a bottle of red wine over Bernstein's head. It's as though Efron, herself the child of two Golden Age Hollywood screenwriters, took one of the oldest cliches in comedy, the pie in the face, and updated it to be a symbol of second-wave feminist fed-uppedness. But what precedes that moment is anguish. In that climactic scene, Rachel thinks this about her husband, who's sitting across the table from her. "I still love you. I still find you interesting. But someday I won't anymore. And in the meantime, I'm getting out. I am no beauty, and I am terrified of being alone. But I would rather die than sit here and pretend it's okay. I would rather die than sit here figuring out how to get you to love me again. I can't stand sitting here with all this rage turning to hurt and then to tears." Like her idol, Dorothy Parker, Efron knew that the greatest comedy arises out of finding ironic distance and therefore control over the things that make us wince, cry, despair. Efron left us not only that key lime pie recipe, but also her recipe for coping. And speaking of coping, for many of us readers, coping with late winter blahs means reaching for a comic novel. Not only classics like Heartburn, but the work of new writers such as Jenny Jackson. Her debut novel, Pineapple Street, is being likened to the work of another late, great, essentially comic writer, Laurie Colwin, because both focus on the foibles of old money families in New York City. That comparison is a bit overblown, but Jackson's Pineapple Street stands on its own as a smart comedy of manners. This is an ensemble novel about members of the wealthy Stockton family that own swaths of Brooklyn Heights and beyond. The most engaging plotline involves a daughter-in-law named Sasha, who hails from a merely middle-class background and struggles to fit in. When her in-laws come to dinner, for instance, their indifference to her food makes her feel like the lady at the Costco free sample table trying to sell warm cubes of processed cheese. Even the most insular characters in Pineapple Street, however, are aware of their privilege. Humor, being topical and dependent on sharp observation of behavior and detail, needs to keep in step with changing times, as Jackson does here. But the shock of social recognition, the moment when a good writer transforms an everyday detail about cheese cubes into an observation about the casual cruelties of class hierarchy, remains as jolting as getting or throwing a pie in the face. Here's to being the thrower.
Maureen Corrigan is a professor of literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Nora Ephron's novel Heartburn on the occasion of its 40th anniversary and the new novel Pineapple Street by Jenny Jackson. Our next guest, Clancy Brown, has been acting in movies and television shows since the early 1980s, often playing villains and sadistic authority figures. He now has a supporting role in John Wick 4, starring Keanu Reeves. I've always been captivated by Brown's acting, but I didn't always enjoy it. When I was a kid growing up in the 80s, Clancy Brown terrified me. Whether he was playing the juvenile prison bully named Viking in the movie Bad Boys, Frankenstein's monster in The Bride, or the one that really got to me, the immortal sword-wielding psychopath the Kurgan in the cult classic Highlander, Clancy Brown caused me many sleepless nights. As I got older, I of course realized that Clancy Brown was just really good at his job. And he's been at that job ever since. His IMDb page credits him for over 300 performances. You may remember him as the cruel prison guard in Shawshank Redemption, or as the menacing preacher in the HBO show Carnival. Recently, he's been the main bad guy in Dexter: New Blood and a U.S. Attorney General on Billions. And those are only a few of his on-screen roles.
Clancy Brown has had practically a whole other career as a voice actor for animated shows and movies. He played Lex Luthor, Superman's arch nemesis for many years, and countless other villains, but his best-known role is as Mr. Krabs in SpongeBob SquarePants. He'll be next seen in John Wick 4, which comes out March 24th. He plays a secretive character named the Harbinger. Let's hear a little bit of Brown's distinctive voice in the role.
Dueling pistols. 30 paces. In the event that both parties survive, each will approach the other at increments of 10 paces until only one remains.
That's Clancy Brown from the upcoming movie John Wick 4. Clancy Brown, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Sam. Good to be here.
So tell us a little bit about the character from the new movie.
Well, let's see. Harbinger is kind of an expositional character. He sort of lets everybody know what the game is, because there has to be somewhat of a plot in this fourth installment of John Wick. Can't just be stunts and stunts and stunts, although it comes pretty close. I actually saw it recently, and it is just beautiful, and the ballet of the action is quite remarkable. But you have to weave it around some kind of motivation, and so this motivation is a duel that John Wick has to have with, and turns out, with one of his friends.
I kind of thought of your character as like a bureaucratic villain. Like, you have all the rules and regulations of how villains are supposed to act.
Yeah, very good. He's absolutely that. He's sort of retired from the field, and now he's pushing paper, as it were. You know.
Sometimes bloody paper.
Yeah, enforcing the rules and customs of the high table.
So as I said in the intro, you've had a very long career with hundreds of roles. But, you know, the one thing you're known very well for is for playing bad guys. You've played a lot of bad guys. When you get a role like that, is there something you try to emphasize in the role?
You know, as long as the script has a rationale for the bad guys never think they're bad guys. You know, they think they're on a mission, they're doing something positive. That's the trick, actually, in just finding a good character that is mal-motivated, and then wrapping your head around that.
Well, let's hear one of these iconic roles. This is from Shawshank Redemption, which is from 1994. You play Captain Hadley, the sadistic head guard of Shawshank State Penitentiary. And this is a sort of turning point scene in the movie. You and some of the other guards are watching over a group of convicts that are tarring a roof. We can't play too much of the scene because it's laden with curses, but you're complaining that your brother has left you a $35,000 inheritance, but you're not going to get any of it because of the taxes. And Tim Robbins' character, Andy Dufresne, has been listening to you. He's a convict, but he was a former banker, and he decides to go up and talk to you, which is taking a really big risk on his life. Let's hear the scene.
Mr. Hadley, do you trust your wife?
Oh, that's funny. You're gonna look funnier sucking my d- with no teeth.
What I mean is, do you think she'd go behind your back, try to hamstring you?
That's it. Step aside, Mert. This d- is having himself an accident.
You don't push him off the roof.
Because if you do trust her, there's no reason you can't keep that 35,000. What did you say?
35,000.
35,000.
All of it.
All of it?
Every penny.
You better start making sense.
If you want to keep all that money, give it to your wife. The IRS allows a one-time only gift to your spouse for up to $60,000.
Oh, tax-free?
Tax-free. IRS can't touch 1 cent.
You're that smart banker would kill his wife, aren't you? Why should I believe a smart banker like you? So I can end up in here with you?
It's perfectly legal. Go ask the IRS. They'll say the same thing. Actually, I feel stupid telling you this. I'm sure you would have investigated the matter yourself.
Hey, I don't need no smart wife-killing banker to tell me where the bear's in the buckwheat.
Of course not. But you do need someone to set up the tax-free gift for you, and it'll cost you. A lawyer, for example.
Bunch of ball washing.
Right. I suppose I could set it up for you. That would save you some money. If you get the forms, I'll prepare them for you, nearly free of charge. I'd only ask 3 beers apiece for each of my co-workers.
Co-workers, get him. That's rich, ain't it?
I think a man working outdoors feels more like a man if you can have a bottle of suds. It's only my opinion. Sir.
you Jimmy staring at? Back to work!
That's a scene from Shawshank Redemption with my guest Clancy Brown, who plays Captain Hadley, the captain of the prison guards. So when you're filming that, are you actually holding Tim Robbins at the edge of a roof?
He was tied off, though. We had he had a safety harness on and everything, and they removed that digitally.
So you didn't have to worry about losing the main actor.
but it's still a little scary, I think, you know. I think Tim was actually nervous. I don't blame him. I was. I'm thinking, I'm holding the star of the show here. I better make sure I have a good grip.
How did you approach that role?
It was such a good script. Everybody loved the script, and I did not read well for it because the casting director was this pretty young lady at the time, and she had like a flowery blouse on, and she smelled very good, and I had to say all that horrible language to her face and be angry, and I just couldn't do it. And I was convinced I had blown the part for until, you know, they started filming, that they were making some kind of mistake. But that's kind of typical for actors. We always believe that we can never believe that we're cast in anything. I remember having a discussion with another actor saying, you know, how can somebody be this miserable and awful? And he pointed out to me that it's a script that's being told from memory. So you don't have to do any, like, really deep work. You just have to present the memory from that guy's point of view, from Red's point of view.
That's interesting that you said you didn't have to humanize the character because he was symbolic.
Yeah, yeah. Most of the heavies in that show are symbolic. All the characters in that show are symbolic, except for probably Brooks and Red and Andy Dufresne. I think those, although they're symbolic in their own way, but they're the most fully realized characters. The rest of them are kind of symbols of hope or symbols of oppression, or that, at least that's the way I saw it. You know,
you said that you felt like you were an imposter on the set. Why was that?
Oh, there were so many great actors on there. I was sure that they had made a mistake. I was certain that they finally chose me to do Captain Hadley because I was taller, and Tim is 6'5" or so. He's a tall actor, and Morgan is a tall actor. So they needed somebody at least, you know, in stature that was close to their size, you know. You couldn't have somebody under 6 feet holding him off the roof. Although I guess you could, you know, there's all sorts of tricks you can do.
Clancy Brown, we need to talk about your very long career as a voice actor in animated roles. Like, how did you get into that line of work?
Well, I love animation. I've always loved animation. And so there was a time in the 90s when they were doing the DC comic characters, Batman and Superman. And so they were kind of going outside the box for casting, and I just had to get in on that. I really wanted to do animation. I think my daughter had just been born, and I wanted to stick around town. I needed to, you know, make some money, and I, you know, just wanted to sit there and be a dad to my daughter. And all the recording studios were in Los Angeles, so I made a real push to try to get on those shows. And a woman named Andrea Romano saw through my nonsense and cast me as Lex Luthor in the Superman series, in the Superman animated series. And she basically taught me how to do voiceover while on the job.
So as people listening to you know, you have a very low and resonant voice. When you started doing this animated work, did you sort of train your voice or try to make your voice do different things?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can't do it the way some of these cats can do it. But it's, you know, it's fun to play around. This isn't, you know, what the voice I'm talking to now isn't Mr. Krabs. He's, you know, he's up here. He's do-dee-dee-dee-dee. And I've done that for so many years now that it's pretty easy to do. I have to try to get away from that.
So when I was researching you, I sort of read through your list of vocal performances on your Wikipedia page. And you have played also a lot of bad guys on animated shows. And I just here's just a few of the names that stood out to me. Colonel Nicola, The Entity, Blowtox, Baron Bone, Robert Maximus, Maximilian Spiel, Big Time Bigelow, Mascue Max, Vice Principal Pangborn, Bark Meat, Yono the Destroyer. So I mean, I haven't seen all these, but are these all like aliens and robots and stuff?
Or? Yeah, I guess. I mean, you know, Vice Principal Pangborn is Vice Principal, right. You know.
But definitely, I assume that's a disciplinary character.
Yeah, right. You know, it's, I'm talking to you now. Why do you think that is? Why do you think I get those roles? Don't get a lot of kid roles.
Well, although, I mean, your most endearing character is, endearing and enduring is Mr. Krabs from SpongeBob SquarePants. I mean, that's been a remarkably long career. I think you started doing that in 1999.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear, you gave us a little bit of live Mr. Krabs, but let's hear a little bit from a scene. For people who are not SpongeBob aficionados, Mr. Krabs is the owner of the Krusty Krab fast food restaurant where SpongeBob and Squidward work. And Mr. Krabs is known as being very greedy and worried about losing his money. And let's hear a clip. You're also here, Tom Kenny, who plays SpongeBob, and Roger Bumpus, who plays Squidward.
Money sweeter than honey. Money, money, this money, money. That profit will make me wallet fat. What? Profit's down $3 from last month. I gotta start running a tighter ship around here.
Thank you for choosing the Krusty Krab. Here's your change.
Mr. Squidward!
Wow.
What's with all this change nonsense?
Over and under, grab the end, put it through here, up and around, round the horn, bring it back home.
SpongeBob, I ain't paying you to play dress up. Breathe on your own time. I don't pay you to breathe.
That's Clancy Brown as Mr. Krabs there. That sounds like a lot of fun to work on that show.
Yeah, we do have a lot of fun. They write it so well and they draw it so funny. I don't, you know, Steve Hillenburg, rest his soul, changed my life. But also is, you know, just singularly hit on something so elemental with that world and those characters. It's a mystery to me.
Now, as Mr. Krabs, you have to cry a lot, it seems. Do you have any tricks on how to do that?
Ooh, yeah, it's just comedy crying. It's a lot like laughing. You know, Mr. Krabs is funny because he's supposed to be the adult, but he's really probably the most childish of all of the characters because he's so singularly focused on one thing, and he doesn't even know why he's focused on that. He just has that kind of dumb obsession with capitalism, you know.
Can you give us an example of your crying? I know it's early in the morning there, and I don't want you to...
Oh, it, you know, yourself. Really depends on what the thing is. If he's just crying about money, it's very performative. It's sincere, but performative. He goes, oh, me money, it's very tight up in the top. And then he stops as soon as the dollars start rolling in.
You know. That's great. You grew up in Urbana, Ohio. Your family had a newspaper publishing business, and both your grandfather and your father had careers as politicians. Your father won his congressional seat in a special election after your grandfather died, and the family moved to D.C. How old were you?
Well, we were back and forth in D.C. I think I spent half a fourth grade in D.C. and half a fourth grade in Urbana, and then we sort of got there full time by the time I was in junior high. So what was that, like 13, 14 years old? Just in time for adolescence.
How was that as a transition, like moving to D.C.?
Well, you know, you're like, you don't really have a posse, you know. You're kind of the new kid or the not new kid. You're the hayseed or you're the city slicker. You know, you're never part of anything. And so, you know, you find theater or you find athletics or sometimes you find both, you know.
Which is what you did, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about how you got into acting. How old were you when you really found a passion for that?
I got turned on to it because I lived next door to a guy whose parents were atomic scientists. They were lived in the house next door to us when I was in junior high or fourth grade or whatever it was, and he was probably ADD because he had so many interests. His name was Robert Kramish, and he would go on these learning jags, you know, the Civil War or World War II or something like that, and one of his jags was Shakespeare, and I was just completely captivated by that language and that poetry at the time, and really enjoyed putting on little plays. Supported him mostly.
He would invite you over and say, hey, let's check out some Shakespeare?
Yeah, he would just like start reading. He started out by telling me the stories, and it was, you know, they were all very bloody and wonderful. Yeah. And then he said, let's put on the Caesar assassination scene. And he was always a lead guy, and I was always the supporting guy. So, yeah. you know, you look back and you're like, oh, okay, that's my niche. All right. Stumbled into that. But then I would just go in the basement and read all these plays, and the language is just spectacular, and I fell in love with that spoken word. My son also became a big spoken word poet when he was in high school. So there's something in the genes is consistent about the love of language and talking out loud.
Well, Clancy Brown, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Clancy Brown is in John Wick 4, which will be in theaters later this month. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. For Terry Gross, I'm Sam Brigger.
Oh, hold on! I thought I felt a little nibble. I reel it in and put it in me sack. Big or small, don't matter, I don't quibble. And you can bet I don't throw nothing back. Shekels, pesos, euros, lira, all currency.